So, it's always good to be back. And today I'm going to be sharing some work in progress on trying to understand how to understand some of the key features from ADS-CFT and how those can be generalized potentially to, for example, flat or de Sitter space times. So before I get started on that, I think it's a good idea to just review what I mean by holography, and ADS-CFT in particular. So the picture I have in mind is that there's a CFT, which is defined, say, on a cylinder, and at large n, or given some other features, you know, probably n equals 4 super Young mills or something concrete like that. This is dual to a theory of gravity in the bulk, which you can think of as filling in the cylinder. And the reason what I mean by they're dual to each other is that there's a specific list of, you know, concepts and operators and Hilbert spaces and stuff like that on the boundary theory, and that has a precise mapping into the bulk theory as well.
Does angular bracket around CCFT?
Yeah.
Do you have a meaning?
That was me just trying to cover all my bases. So what I mean is that, you know, depending on the theory, for example, in JT gravity, a JT gravity is not dual to a specific CFT, but an ensemble of CFTs. And some people interpret this as being in the bulk as showing up in the form of wormholes and some sort of coarse graining. So I didn't mean anything super political by it. I was just saying
I just didn't know if it was intentional.
Yeah, it was intentional. It was intentional. So by this line, what I really am trying to say is that somehow the dynamics in the CFT, or the ensemble of CFTs, determines the dynamics in the bulk. And more specifically, if you give me the state of the CFT restricted to a subregion of the cylinder, say a causal diamond, this is dual to the entanglement wedge in the bulk, which I'll describe more in detail in the next slide. And one of the cornerstones of ADS-CFT is that if you want to compute the entropy of this subregion on the CFT, this is dual to the generalized entropy in the bulk through something called the Ryu-Takenagi formula, which I'll call the RT formula. So just to review what the RT formula says in ADS-CFT, if I give you a state on the subregion R of the boundary, then I can compute for you that entropy using the area of a minimal surface, which shoots into the bulk, plus some bulk entropy due to the matter fields. But the RT formula gives us more than just computing the entropy. It also tells us about how the bulk is reconstructed from the knowledge of the state on the boundary. So just to make sure that this satisfies the consistency checks, to make sure that this is an interpretation that makes sense, this is one of the motivations for entanglement wedge reconstruction, is that all of these properties hold in the bulk, is that if you give me a smaller subset of that original region, then their entanglement wedges are always nested in the proper way. The no cloning theorem holds in the way that you would naively expect, that if I give you two disjoint intervals, then their entanglement wedges don't overlap because I shouldn't be able to reconstruct on either interval separately. And also these surfaces satisfy strong subadditivity, that these generalized entropies, even though they're defined in terms of areas of surfaces and von Neumann entropies added in a particular way, they really are satisfying the conditions we would expect of an entropy. So you can derive that this is the right formula to use in the case of a static space-time, or at least a state defined on a static slice, using the gravitational path integral. This is something Lukwitz and Maldacena did. And you can even derive that you can actually reconstruct operators in the bulk entanglement wedge using only operators in the boundary. And this is something JLMS proved. This is basically the statement that because the relative entropies are the same, this leads to reconstruction in a unique manner. And you can sort of get a feel for both of these properties at the same time using tensor network models of quantum gravity on a static slice. This proposal has covariant generalizations that are well known by now. The HRT proposal, or QES, depending on if you have a dynamical spacetime, for example. But for the rest of this talk, I'm going to restrict myself to the case where the state is on a static slice. And we can talk about how this proposal I'm going to show you guys generalizes to covariant situations as well. And the key thing that I'm interested in for this talk is how we can generalize the RT formula to beyond ADS spacetimes. Because, you know, for calculating the entropy, I have a subregion of the boundary, which specifically requires ADS boundary conditions. And if we're trying to think about flat space or de Sitter, for example, say we're doing celestial holography or something, then it's interesting to consider how these sorts of tools and ideas can generalize to those settings. So in order to get motivation for what to expect in the first place, let's continue talking about ADS and see what lessons we can learn from these from ADS-CFT. So instead of giving you a subregion of the boundary, I'm just going to be talking about subregions of the bulk from now on. One of the motivations for doing this is that in one of the big differences between ADS and flat space, for example, is the behavior of asymptotic infinity, you know, the structure of the boundary. And so by focusing in on the bulk physics, there's some potential for generalization that might be more natural. So the situation I'm imagining in this picture is I'm giving you a subregion of the bulk that's a time band, let's say, surrounding sort of like everything except for a sphere. And if you give me just the low energy operators, just the usual QFT operators in the bulk theory, then these operators know nothing about what's going on in the gray circle, in the middle of the bulk. This is just microcausality of QFT. Space-like separated operators commute. But if you give me more and more information about the quantum gravity degrees of freedom in A, say, then I also have the full information about what's going on in the UV completion, which we think of as living at the boundary, even though I'm giving you the information in this bulk region. And using this this boundary information, we can actually reconstruct what's going on in the full spacetime. This is sort of the main, like taking the entanglement wedge of the full boundary is the full spacetime. All right? And this logic continues even if I only gave you a subregion of the bulk which only covers part of the boundary. So the picture, again, is that I've given you the non-perturbative quantum gravity degrees of freedom localized to A in this blue region of the bulk. And using these degrees of freedom in the bulk, I can reconstruct what's going on the larger entanglement wedge, E of A.
So can I ask that down?
Yeah.
Somebody who doesn't do this very well. So you're in the little shaded region, you're giving me just like perturbation theory around the bulk theory, so like corrosion function of operators in that region. And then where are you adding to the boundary to go like the rest of the way in?
Yeah, that's a good question. So if you gave me just the low energy, like the just the low energy operators, and by that I mean, you know, just the purely bulk degrees of freedom, like gravitons and stuff like that, to some finite order perturbation theory, then you wouldn't expect to be able to reconstruct E of A, and you wouldn't expect to be able to reconstruct all of E of A. Only things in what a you know, an if from qubit person might say, or in the code subspace, or just which is just a fancy way of saying, like the low energy degrees of freedom, basically. So the picture is that because I've given you the full information on this blue region, this intuitively should include the full information about what's going on the boundary, and so I should also be able to reconstruct what's going on in this other part of the bulk E of A.
What do you mean with this information? Can you be a little bit more specific? So like, I talk about the two-point function on the boundary CFT. I'm having trouble.
Yeah, that's a good question. So let's just talk about not the bulk region right now, but just if it was just a boundary region, like just a boundary CFT, and then let's talk about what I mean when I'm talking about the bulk region after that. So what I mean by information is that I've given you a state which is defined on this subregion of the boundary, and using that state and the algebra of operators associated with this this boundary region, I can reconstruct for you all of the two-point functions, for example, that you'd want to know, right? And the statement that I can reconstruct what's going on in E of A is that in the, again, ADS-CFT example, is that if you give me a, say, a two-point function in the bulk that is localized to this region, E of A, then I can use the operators which have purely support on the boundary, and I can smear them in a particular way which will equal those bulk correlators. Okay? And you know, if you want to make this really precise, you need to use algebras and talk about modular flows and stuff like that, but that's not something I'm going to get into at this moment. And one thing that's definitely not clear when I say like the full bulk degrees of freedom on A is what that like dual theory is. So in ADS, for example, I have this clear idea that The non-perturbative completion of gravity in the full slice looks like a CFT. You know, it has the Hilbert space of a CFT, the operators of a CFT, and you know, the theory, the full non-perturbative definition of the theory in the bulk that's dual to is not necessarily clear. So it's not clear at all what I mean by the degrees of freedom localized to A. What I'm going to argue for you later on is that actually you don't need to know that. You just need to know, you just need to treat gravity seriously as an effective field theory, and then that'll give you the right answers, for example, for the entropy of this region.
Can I ask one more question, which is a dangerous answer? So if you go to slide back,
okay.
I would have thought like Carlo Barber, maybe I don't know the authors, who needs to be pulsating, would tell me that I need the degrees of freedom on the full like blue. Then tell me everything, say, on the co-slice, right?
Yeah.
So what is the role of that strip A?
So the role of the strip A is just, I'm trying to define the boundary as a limit of a bulk region being really big. So that's really the motivation, is that I want to think about gravity in the bulk, and we know really well what goes on when you think of things restricted to the boundary, and I want to view this boundary as the limiting case of something in the bulk.
So like in this figure, like the E of A would be the same for anything homologous to the boundary, right? Like it wouldn't care about a radius or anything there. So what's
the... It doesn't care about the radius of this A. That's true. I was just... Like, if you give me everything bigger than a certain radius, in particular, you've also given me the boundary. So in some sense, it feels redundant from the viewpoint of ADS CFT. But if you're in De Sitter, for example, then it's not clear what... there's no boundary in the first place. And so just thinking about the bulk region on its by itself will be a fruitful thing to do. Any other questions? So another motivation comes from thinking about islands. So if I have a black hole that's evaporating in an ADS spacetime, then you know, that emits some Hawking radiation, which I've sort of denoted by this green blob. And in ADS CFT, we've come to understand that you can reconcile the physics of a black hole. You know, there's these semi-classical calculations you can do about the entropy always going up. But then once you start including other saddles in the gravitational path integral, you can actually derive that there's a new entanglement wedge that pops, a new extremal surface which pops up, this E of A, and you can actually use the radiation to reconstruct what's going on inside the black hole. And the thing that's kind of strange about all these calculations is that they necessarily, in all the calculations I've seen, have some sort of reservoir or external bath where you collect the radiation, because otherwise it'll just bounce back and the black hole won't actually evaporate. But if instead of having it actually leak out and talking about it reaches infinity and then goes into a reservoir, if you imagine collecting this Hawking radiation at a finite radius, finite distance from the black hole, and doing all of the same computations on the Hawking radiation that you would have done in the reservoir, then you'd expect to still be able to reconstruct the information that's inside the black hole. There's nothing about the fact that the radiation has left the space-time which is conceptually should be important for the fact that the information is located in the radiation. Again, by information, I mean that there exists operations I can do on the state of this Hawking radiation to then, say, calculate a two-point function inside of the black hole's interior. The last example I'm going to give, which motivates this idea of bulk-to-bulk holography, comes from tensor network models. So for those of you who aren't familiar, this is a picture of a tensor network, which is like a discretization of this static slice sigma I was drawing before. And all these boxes I'm imagining are tensors, which are, say, random with respect to some ensemble. And I've contracted the legs together in a way consistent with this diagram. And what I mean by this blue region is that I fixed for you the state on these bulk legs, which are these dots kind of sticking out of the board. And by fixing these bulk legs, and also the operators sort of on the boundary, on the cuts here, you can actually construct an isometry, or at least a partial isometry, to the leg in this. You can push the cut almost to construct a partial isometry to reconstruct what's going on this leg as well. So normally, what you do is you fix the legs on the boundary. And you sort of do this game of moving the cut And then that leads you to the RT formula that I was describing on a few slides ago. But the same formula, the same sort of algorithm that lets you talk about the RT formula from fixing the boundary legs works if you fix the bulk legs instead. So it's the same picture of this tensor network. We're just fixing a different subset of the information. And we're getting the same physics of being able to reconstruct more than we started with. So considering all these examples, this motivates strongly the idea that entanglement wedges should not be associated with boundary subregions, but should actually be associated with bulk subregions instead. And we should view boundary subregions and reservoirs, for example, in the case of islands, as just limits of bulk subregions instead. So this is actually a proposal which appeared about a year ago by Busso and Pennington, which they claim that if you give a bulk subregion in any spacetime, I draw it in here in ADS just for convenience, but it should work for any spacetime, and you give me, again, the non-perturbative degrees of freedom localized to A, then there should be a larger region, E of A, which you can reconstruct the lower energy operators with. And this E of A has two components to its definition. The first is that it should always be bigger than the original region, which intuitively makes sense, because if you've told me what's going on in this region A, I should be able to at least tell you what's going on at that region A. And the other thing that E of A does is it minimizes the generalized entropy. So among all wedges which are larger than the region, it minimizes the generalized entropy. So the classic example is that if you have an ADS spacetime and you have some region, some single sphere, let's say, which is not convex, then this procedure will give you the convex hull. So just this bulk definition alone satisfies other crucial consistency conditions. For example, if you take the limit where A is a subregion of the boundary, this reduces exactly the RT formula. So in the cases where we would expect this to work, it does as expected. Another is that it satisfies nesting, that if you give me two bulk subregions which are contained within each other, then their entanglement wedges are also contained within each other. It satisfies no cloning in the sense that if you give me two regions and their entanglement wedges don't overlap, then, sorry, if the entanglement wedge of B doesn't overlap with A and vice versa, then their entanglement wedges won't overlap with each other either. So if you give me all of the information on A and all the information on B, then there's no region that they can both reconstruct with perfect accuracy. Another is that this proposal satisfies strong subadditivity, which I didn't reproduce here just because it's kind of longer, just because it's E of A instead of just A. But that's another thing you need in order for this to be a truly a consistent interpretation as an entropy. So what do we?
Is there anything physical about why you would think if you give me some data, it's not convex, if there's some surface that, like, why E of A is larger than A in that context? I don't.
Yeah, so there's a few motivations. One is that this is like the continuum version of this tensor network drawing that I did before. Another is that, well, hopefully at the end of the talk you'll have more intuition, because I'm going to actually derive this entropy formula for you. And the main tool that I'm going to be using to derive this entropy formula is including the gravitational edge modes associated with this region. So what mediates that is, well, maybe I can answer that question after I explain the tools we're going to use before I just start explaining them. Yes.
So it's a question like every time I see the generalized entropy expression,
okay,
because it looks like the first two terms of the power series in G Newton.
That's true.
And I never understand why it makes sense to keep the first two terms of the power series.
So
if the term matters, then all the other terms would matter, right?
So the reason why I'm writing this formula is that I'm interpreting this as being like you said, the leading order terms as G Newton goes to zero, and there should be high. And one way to think about this area is just as a counter term for the divergences in this von Neumann entropy. And when you include higher order powers of G Newton, this will just be more counter terms induced by gravity to cancel off these divergences.
I don't see the point of including the second term, because if it matters, then the third term would probably also matter. If it doesn't
matter, I see your point now. So that's a good question. Yeah. Like, why not include higher order terms? So one motivation is that even if the value of this second term is very small, its gradients could be very large, and that's what happens in these island setups.
And the same for the next term.
So I haven't personally thought too deeply about all of the other higher order terms in this expansion. I think it just depends on which order in G Newton you want to have accuracy to, right? Because if G Newton is small enough, then, you know, if you're doing, for example, QED, right, you consider the alpha, alpha squared, alpha cubed corrections to certain things. And I mean, in principle, you should include all those corrections as well. But
then I have the thing only the second term is much, much smaller than the first. So whenever you tell me, no, the second term might matter in this calculation, then that calculation to me looks very, very suspicious.
Can I just say something? Isn't it because it's in the exponent? So exponential of the entropy would be some very big exponent and a prefactor. And the other terms would be subleading, right? It's often the case that you care about the first two precisely because one is the leading exponent and one is the prefactor.
Yeah. Yeah, that's true.
Thanks.
Cool, thanks for the question. And so, just to recap, we're gonna prove this is the entropy of this region A is in fact given by this formula. So I said the tool we're gonna use are edge modes, and so just for the benefit of everyone, I thought I would review what edge modes are. So before we talk about edge modes, let's talk about entropy again. And if I want to tell you what the entropy of a subregion is, the most basic thing I need to do is bipartition my Hilbert space into a tensor product between the system I actually care about, which I'm imagining is like the left-hand side of a lattice, and everything else, or which could be like the right-hand side of a lattice, let's say. But there are two issues which could keep my Hilbert space from factorizing in such a clean way. The first issue could be because of divergences in the UV. For example, I could have an infinite amount of entanglement between the inside and outside of my region. This is what happens in quantum field theory, for example. And there could also be IR issues, which come from a Gauss law constraint, let's say, correlating the left and the right, which keeps me from being able to write an actual tensor product state of the left and the right. There's a constraint which always correlates them together. And so in this talk, we're going to tame the UV divergences by adding cutoffs for all of our UV divergences, and then we're going to remove them. We're going to make sure to remove them at the end. But this leaves the IR issues of constraints on our Hilbert space, and that's what we're going to be using edge modes to resolve. So just to make sure we're all on the same page, let's talk about edge modes in a U1 lattice gauge theory, so there's no UV divergences. And the picture I have here is that on my lattice, in my Hilbert space, I have states which, say, correspond to a Wilson line. So that's what this red thing is a Wilson line. And when I want to bipartition my Hilbert space and trace out the degrees of freedom on this right-hand side of the lattice, this leaves behind Wilson lines which cross this point. And this exposes extra degrees of freedom because now I have open Wilson lines in my theory, whereas I only had closed Wilson lines before. So if you tried to define the full Hilbert space and you didn't worry about these open Wilson lines, then you just take the left, tensor the right, and suddenly there's no operators or states which correspond to Wilson lines straddling the cut. So just the naive tensor product is strictly a subspace of the original Hilbert space. Whereas if I tried to include all of the open Wilson lines and tensor those together with the left and the right, suddenly I have states which have non-zero charge, and that's bigger than the original Hilbert space. So there's some sort of nesting going on there. And in fact, precisely what you need to do is take this bigger Hilbert space and just restrict yourself to only include the closed Wilson lines, which are precisely when the charge vanishes at every link on the site, on the lattice. And this is sort of an abelian picture, you know, Q plus Q bar is zero. So Q is like the charge of the open Wilson lines on the from the left, and the Q bar on the right, and you need to make sure they cancel pairwise. You're projecting onto that subspace. And in the non-abelian case, there's a generalization of this called the entangling product, which I'm sure some of you have heard Laurent talk about before. And the big picture is just you have your original Hilbert space, and you know there's a way to define it that's sort of too big, and another one which is too small, but somehow this entangling product is getting it just right, just restricting to exactly the degrees of freedom you needed to in the first place. So let's talk a little bit about this extended Hilbert space, because this is going to be important when we compute the entropy and gravity. So the way to think about these edge modes that live at this cut is as Stoker-Borg fields. It's like a choice of, in the U1 case, it's like a choice of phase and the normal electric field, normal to the cut, and these form a canonical pair, and then you just consider wave functions over that canonical pair. So in the full Hilbert space, I have a gauge symmetry, in this particular presentation of the theory at least, I have a gauge symmetry, and there's a gauge group, which are just U1 transformations on the left, on the right, and along the cut. But in the extended Hilbert space, the gauge symmetry is just the U1 transformations on the left. What was a gauge symmetry in the full Hilbert space has become a global symmetry for the extended Hilbert space. Because if I do a U1 transformation on these open Wilson lines, depending on the representation, this will change the, in general, this will change the state. And what this implies is that the extended Hilbert space actually breaks into superselection sectors for this global symmetry. And the thing that was going wrong before I took the entangling product is that when I just tensor together H left and H right, I have a big global symmetry of this tensor product at Hilbert space. And what the entangling product does is by restricting to the zero charge subspace is exactly just gauging this global symmetry, which then gives you the gauge symmetry that you expected from the full Hilbert space in the first place. So this is intuitively how to think about what's going on. So gravity has a presentation as a gauge theory where the gauge group is diffeomorphisms, and that means that gravity also will have edge modes associated with it. So if you use the tools of covariant phase space, you can figure out exactly what these edge modes are, and they basically, because I said they were Stoker-Borg fields before, correspond to coordinate systems on your spacetime, on the region. And the gauge group splits, just like in U1, into three pieces. Diffeomorphisms with compact support on your region, diffeomorphisms with compact support on the complement, and kind of everything else, things that straddle the cut, that could move the cut around. And before I talk more about this group, I just want to say a little more about how to think about the edge modes in gravity. And the picture I'm going to be taking for the rest of the talk is what I mean by a subregion is I have some abstract version, like some abstract causal diamond, which I'm not associating with my global spacetime. And then I imagine putting this causal diamond into the global spacetime by embedding it onto this slice, let's say. Okay, so I picked a particular embedding, my favorite embedding, which I'll call phi sub e. And this is how I'm thinking about my region. And if I give you a diffeomorphism on the target space there, which could move it around, then I could think about this as just being choosing a different embedding for my region. Okay, so this is how I'm thinking about what this group is really representing, is you could think about it as representing different possible embeddings of your region in the first place. And depending on what this embedding is, it could make the region look much different than it did before. But the key thing is that whenever I'm talking about elements of this group, so I should say ECS stands for extended corner symmetry group. And when I'm thinking about these elements, what I'm actually thinking about are the embeddings of my region into the spacetime. So I could think about phi sub e, you know, if I just look at the region originally, then I could take the embedding in those coordinates and view that as phi sub e, and then that parameterizes the rest of the embeddings.
It's a different embedding, you mean modulo diffeomorphisms of A?
Say it one more time.
You say embedding, you mean modulo diffeomorphisms of A?
Modulo diffeomorphisms of A. So when I drew this before, I was imagining ECS as like a quotient of, I could have two diffeomorphisms which only differ with compact support on A, and I'm kind of viewing those as the same embedding, because I'm viewing diff A as being a gauge symmetry. And by diff A, I always mean diffeomorphisms with compact support on A. Okay? So now that we have a better understanding of what these edge modes represent, let's talk about the group they transform under, and that's this extended corner symmetry group. So it turns out that the group in which these this ECS, the form in which this group takes is very universal and has the following form. So you can think about this group as being diffeomorphisms which preserve the 2 plus d minus 2 decomposition of the metric. And by this I mean I've imagined my corner is some d minus 2 dimensional submanifold, and I've broken my metric into like a normal plane and the metric on the actual surface. And these are the diffeomorphisms which sort of keep that splitting intact. So the way to think about diff A, diff partial A is as you would usually expect, is just changing the coordinates on the actual cut on the corner. And I should really point out that in the U1 case, that's sort of all there was. There was only the diff partial A analogy. But in gravity, one thing that's very different is that we get these extra two terms as well. And that's actually going to be very crucial to why we're getting this, the formula we do for the entropy at the end of the day, is the fact that there's these extra terms that gravity has that Yang-Mills doesn't. So what is this SL2R doing? You could think about it as a generalization of boosts. And what it's doing is, so I should explain this picture. What I'm imagining is I have my, I have my region, which I drew as some Pac-Man shape, and I'm picking a particular point on the boundary, and I'm looking at the plane, sort of normal to that cut, which is, you can think about it as like the two null directions, x plus and x minus, okay? So that point is representing just a particular point on the boundary, all right? And what this SL2 is doing is basically doing boosts in this plane, okay? And also other, just any SL2 transformation on this normal plane, but boosts are an example. So that's a good way to think about it. But the key thing is that these transformations, because they're linear, are preserving the location of this point. Whereas these R2, you can think of as just being null translations, which actually wiggle the point around. So you can actually talk about, so when I say all embeddings, the reason why this is consistent is because when they transform under this part of the group, under this R2 factor, then I actually can get radial and time-like fluctuations of the region.
So when you say del A little subscript, you mean maps from del A to?
I mean maps, yeah. So I'm imagining doing an SL2 product R2 transformation at every point on the corner. Yeah, I'll talk more about this group in just a moment. But are there, before we keep going, are there any questions about something I've said so far? Cool. So the key thing is that this group, like in the U1 case, forms a global symmetry group for my extended Hilbert space of my region A. And so that means that my Hilbert space breaks into super selection sectors, into representations of this group. Okay? So the setup I'm imagining is that I have a Hilbert space defined on the full Cauchy slice that was the big circle I was talking about before. And this has some operators associated with it that form an algebra I'll call A sub sigma. And what I'm doing is I'm picking a state in this total Hilbert space, psi. And I'm assuming this state has a nice interpretation as like a single copy of a fixed background geometry I'll call G naught. And inside of these operators, I'm including perturbatively quantized gravitons. So the total metric has the following form. And what we're going to do is we're going to work perturbatively in Newton's constant and take the limit as G Newton goes to zero in the end. So this is very standard of gravitational path integral calculations, which is what we'll be doing in just a moment. So just to emphasize, we're starting off with this total Hilbert space, and by tracing out A prime, the complement, we're being left behind with the extended Hilbert space, which takes the form of all the bulk operators with compact support on the region, as well as wave functions over these embeddings. And what this is doing is we're taking the global state psi, and we're getting some mixed state, which I'll just call rho sub A, which depends both on the region that we're considering, so what we've traced out, as well as the bulk fields on that region, as well as the embeddings that we could consider for that region. So this is very important. So I'll just emphasize it one more time. H sigma is the total Hilbert space on the full slice, exactly. And HA, which I'll call QFT, are all of my QFT operators, which include gravitons, because they're just perturbatively quantized. Okay? And diffeomorphisms with compact support on my region are a gauge symmetry of this QFT Hilbert space. I also have this L2 factor, which are wave functions over the edge modes, or wave functions over the embeddings. But those of you who saw the group I wrote down before might be worried that this group is very large because, for example, it contains diffeomorphisms of a sphere, and this might not have a nice inner product which converges. But what we're going to do is, because we're already treating the QFT Hilbert space as an effective field theory, one of the reasons why this group is too big is because diffeomorphisms of a sphere, you can consider like sub-Planckian fluctuations, and that's just degrees of freedom that we didn't want to include in the first place. So what we're going to do in practice is, we said that the Hilbert space was splits into super-selection sectors for representations of this group, and we're just going to truncate to some very high-dimensional representation. So like I said, we write the Hilbert space as a sum over representations, and as long as we picked a global state, which is invariant under diffeomorphisms, which move the corner around, which will be the case because the full space of diffeomorphisms is a gauge symmetry for H sigma, the state after we trace out A prime will always take the following form.
Can I ask that question?
Yeah.
In most of what you're setting up, and I was going to wait until the end, but now that there's some people are going to be killing me, it seems like I could try to do the same thing at infinity, right? Like now,
sure.
Like, the gauge transformation has something like the corner symmetry at infinity.
Yeah.
So then the question would be, is this kind of thing where you're truncating the corner algebra because of some trans-Planckian arguments grew up, if there's like a very large radius scale now? Like, I don't know, like, can you do the same? Like, would it be different if you're at like a very large scale?
Yeah, that's a good question. So this argument about like sub-Planckian fluctuations, really, you know, what's important is that I'm capping off at some finite dimensional but maybe large representation. So if you have a very large radius, maybe you need to include more representations to have more and more fine-grained fluctuations. But the key thing is that there's still a cutoff. That's the thing that I care most about.
So really the composite things like spherical harmonics.
Yes, it's a little like decomposing in spherical harmonics and just restricting to some very large L. Exactly. Now, one thing I'm not doing at any point in this talk is going to be telling is characterizing for you the specific representations of this group, because it's a very complicated group and that would be a very hard problem in general. But it turns out that we actually don't need to do that to get the results that at the end of the day. So. That's one thing that...
You know, you're not truncating representations of the group, right? You're truncating the group itself.
Truncating the group itself, exactly.
Where, like, if you have arbitrary harmonics in a very large sphere, that's a very different length scale than if you have a tiny sphere.
Yeah, I take your point. Now, the thing to keep in mind, though, is that even if the radius is larger, right, the group itself is still the same. It's just diffeomorphism. It's like coordinate transformations on the region, and then this SL2 cross R2 piece, which is, again, a very universal, takes a universal form. Now, yeah, it takes, so even if the radius changes, what's most important is just there exists a cutoff. And maybe you need to take higher if there's a larger, if you have a different cutoff in mind, like a larger radius sphere. But the important thing is just that the highest dimensional representation is finite dimensional. If you're a math person, then one way to say this is that one of the big problems is that there's no Haar measure over this group because it's not locally compact. It's like not finite dimensional in a way that's really bad. So there's no Haar measure. And what you're doing is you're taking a locally compact subgroup is one way to think about what's going on. So everything, all the Haar measures make sense, and you can take inner products, and everything is bounded, and everyone's happy.
But you need the Haar measures.
Sorry?
But you need to have measures.
Just because I said it was L2, which is a Hilbert space, and usually you define the... usually you define the inner product using something like the Haar measure. Why do we need the theory in this representation?
How do you know which... How do you land on a representation and show the group?
Say it one more time.
How did you... So you knew you were going to get some representation of this group. Mm-hmm. Why this specific representation?
I'm imagining...
Schwarz has a ton of unitary representation.
That's true. But what I'm imagining is this is like the regular representation. And I'll talk about this in just a bit, but for nice enough groups, the regular representation kind of contains... So the key thing is that if you look at this decomposition... Where was it? If you look at this decomposition, right, there's a sum over all the irreducible representations. If you want to have one space, which sort of is a direct sum of all the irreducible representations with the proper multiplicities to account for degeneracies, then this ends up being just the regular representation.
But you multiply it by the whole, by HA. So perhaps what you meant is that Hilbert is some subspace of that?
It's a subspace of this. That's probably a better way to put it, yeah. Because like I said, there's a super selection sector effect going on. So I need to actually be projecting onto like combined roots, which I need to basically, because I'm considering, I'm starting off with states, which were gauge invariant under the full group of diffeomorphisms, the actual things I'm embedding into, right, have always take the following form, which is a subspace. So that's true. I probably should have put a subset symbol. So let me just emphasize what this is saying, is that when I consider the mixed state, which comes from a well-defined state on the global Hilbert space, then it always breaks into sums over representations. This P of R is obviously just a weighting to make sure everything, to make sure rho of A is normalized. Rho of R are quantum fields, again, including gravitons, which when I apply a diffeomorphism in this group, transform in a particular representation. And this identity factor is basically just the maximally mixed state for the edge mode degrees of freedom. And so if you just take trace of rho log rho of this state, then it always decomposes into the following form. So I haven't made any assumptions about the state other than it came from a gauge invariant state on the global.
So you would suppose that if I zero just one presentation, if R is the only state which is invariant under the group?
This is the only, yeah, it's like a Schur's lemma type thing.
Yes.
Exactly. So this equation right here is very important because this is the starting point of all the calculations we'll be doing for the rest of the talk. So I emphasize that the first term is kind of like a Shannon entropy of this P of R term. The second is just coming from the 1 over D of R, making sure the identity was normalized. And the others are basically like an ensemble average over the different representations of rho of R.
So there's implicitly, you're saying if you have a given region, you're going to be tracing over the, like, I guess this, these edge degrees of freedom.
Yeah, if you exclude things outside, you need to also be including the edge modes in the actual region itself. And that just comes from considering making sure that your full theory is gauge invariant when you glue it back together with another state outside. And when I glue it back together, I mean take a tensor product and restrict to the, and then gauge the global symmetry of ECS. Okay?
Can I ask one question?
Yes.
Do you need to make some... Do you need to know what P of R is, and do you make some choice for it?
I will make a choice for it later, and I'll give a justification for that. So ask me that question again in just a few slides. But this is going to be our starting point for the rest of the talk. So one problem is that when I write this sum over R, I'm really imagining a sum up to some cutoff of a high-dimensional representation. And so before we go any further, we need to talk about how we're going to renormalize this. Yes?
Why is that? So before you were cutting the group, now you're also cutting our presentations?
Yes. I'm thinking about...
the cutoff you were talking about before was just, you look at the smaller group, you don't look at it.
Look at the smaller group. So they're kind of related to each other because they're both about like making sure that the Hilbert space is well defined.
Suppose the most radical cut at all, I just look at constant function, I just then it's a choir there. Mm-hmm. Why would I need to cut representations of a choir?
So one reason to do it is because if I don't do that, then for example this state rho sub A as I define.
It's usually an integral, right? Not a sum.
It should be an integral, yeah.
They're all the principal series, right?
Yeah, so if the group is not compact, for example, then...
The group is not compact, it's essentially then it's actually many copies.
Exactly. So I'm imagining one way to phrase it is instead of just... So the reason I'm cutting things off, cutting off the representations and not just the group is because I need... I need everything to be normalized. I want to say the identity is normalized in some sense. And because I have this like 1 over D factor, and if I don't cut off the representations, the identity is not normalized.
But the representation is also, so it's a choir has no finite dimensional representation, right? So this D this formula can only be very evocative, right? Because you're looking at a group like a Sechuar representation of a final dimension, but there's no dimension of a representation of a Sechuar, right?
Yeah.
So it seems to me that you're worrying about higher order effects than just the fact that this formula should have an integral and should have identities on an interdimensional space. These arcs are not one dimensional things, right?
Yes, but at the end of the day, the thing that will be important is actually not the, for example, if you take like an abelian subgroup of SL2R, then this is fine. And in fact, the abelian subgroup, the thing I'm really most interested in is going to be these R2s.
Okay.
Sorry,
just to be clear.
So one question I have is, I have the SL2 over everything, right? Mm-hmm. So thankfully I would have thought that like the super translations for the horizon would be like a choice of SL2Rs around that horizon. Mm-hmm. Or even be an entropy for the black hole. Like would this go to Andy Story if you try to send a software into the SL2R?
At the end of the day, this entropy has three terms. And what I'm going to do in practice is I'm going to cancel the first term with the second term, because we'll see they always have the opposite sign. And I'll justify why I'm doing that. So that actually is a good point. Let me talk about exactly what I'm going to be simplifying this formula to. So what I'm going to do is take the omega to be the sum over the dimensions of all the representations I'm considering, which you can think of as just some sort of partition function at infinite temperature, which is just counting the number of microstates that I have in the theory. What I'm going to do is I'm going to renormalize explicitly by just rescaling the trace over these representations on the matter degrees of freedom, because that's the only trace over the representations that's left behind. And in order to do that, I need to also rescale the states rho sub r, so that way everything stays normalized. And if I do that, then because of this log rho right here, I'm going to get an extra factor of log omega, which pops out, which reduces the entropy by log omega. And if I just absorb that log omega into the second term, then it takes the form, the entropy reduces to a relative entropy between the probabilities I'm actually considering and sort of a microcanonically uniform distribution over the edge mode degrees over these representations. And then I also get an ensemble average over S of R, which I've just defined as this trace of rho log rho in the bulk fields. So the thing I actually care about is at the end of the day, I'm going to be taking P of R to be. So let me first just, before I explain that, are there any questions about this simplification? And one thing I just want to add is that this rescaling of a trace is actually a very natural thing to do. From the viewpoint of, if you consider von Neumann algebras, if anyone's familiar with that story here, exactly in type 2 algebras, the trace is, if it's type 2 infinity, then the trace is only well defined up to an overall scale. And that's just exactly what we're doing. We're renormalizing the trace by rescaling it. And there's been a lot of investigations recently which have argued that when you include perturbative fluctuations of finite regions in gravity, actually you do get a type 2 algebra associated with that region. And so this is very consistent with that philosophy, even though we're not explicitly computing the type of the algebra, let's say. So what we're going to do is we're going to take a semi-classical assumption that P of R is basically uniform in the microcanonical ensemble. So why would we do something like that? Well, the intuition is that if you have a flat distribution in the charge basis, in this representation basis, that's very peaked in the basis of embeddings. And a semi-classical state has a very well-defined embedding that you use to glue a region with its complement. There's a smoothness there. Another way to think about it, which is probably better, is you could take P of R to be some coherent state over these representations. And in the limit where you take omega goes to infinity, the variance will get very large for a typical Gaussian. And this will make it flat as well. So the most important thing is that I'm making the substitution that P of R is flat in the microcanonical ensemble. And so my entropy is the only term which is left behind is this ensemble over entropies of the fields in particular representations, and I know exactly what that ensemble is. It's the microcanonically flat ensemble. So that's the key reason why we're, and then again, with this recent investigations into observers and quantum gravity, they actually make the exact same assumption that they restrict themselves to states where the observer, so to speak, is very flat, and that's precisely what we're doing here.
Once you get to this point, you could probably try to rewrite it in terms of in a way that works for representations that are not finite dimensional.
Yes.
Like a Planck-Shannon measure.
Yes, exactly. So that's why I wasn't too worried about your question before, is because I'm going to do more manipulations where I'm not as worried about the points you were bringing up. But just it was easiest to derive this formula from the sort of very naive cutoff version from before, just for the point of this talk at least.
But like, so then in principle though, one could kind of check, like, if, I mean, I think that the time translations should be the SL2, right?
Exactly, contained within the SL2.
Should be that. So this claim of Anisov here is that the edge degree of Riemannic is the SL2 R reps are
So you're saying if you take a state that's not flat, but you include some finite excitations above?
I mean, I don't know where it falls into this assumption, but I'm saying I think I could tell you or check with Luca and Laurent that like the horizon degrees of the any called soft here are a part of this symmetry, which I think is the SL2.
Yeah, exactly.
Now you have it seems like a general formula or a set of assumptions that gives you then an entropy for the external region. That seems like
something. Yeah, that would be interesting to, I'd love to chat about that more.
Could you perhaps check this formula first in situations so the group is actually compact? And then?
Yeah, so one thing I'll talk about at the end is one thing we'd really like to do is consider
a lattice system. And then see, apply this formula in order to derive it.
Exactly. So one thing I should say is that this formula, is very well defined and is true for not gravity but like lattice U1 gauge theory, for example. This is just a true formula for something like this, yes. And I'm taking inspiration from this lattice model.
But is the R equal to the R, does it work naturally in that context?
Let me show you what I'm about to do, and then you can tell me if you think it's natural. So the next thing we're going to do is, well, we have this expression for the entropy, and we need to start worrying about including more and more representations, removing the cutoff. And so effectively what we're going to do is we're going to Fourier transform the trace into a trace not over the representation basis, but over the group elements themselves. Okay. So by trace, I really am imagining some sort of Haar integral because I've cut off what the group is. And the intuition for why it needs to have this precise d of r is as follows, is because if you look at wave functions over the corner symmetry group, which I'll refer to as G for right now, the precise way in which it splits into representations has a multiplicity of exactly the dimension of the group. So it means that if you look at the trace over the regular representation, this splits into d of r, the sum over r, d of r times the trace of r.
I expected to see this.
Exactly, yeah. So that's exactly what I have right here, right? I have a sum over d of r, trace over r, and this is the thing which I'm substituting for a trace over the group in the regular representation.
We could have here without passing to representations.
I absolutely think you could pass here without talking about representations, but from the lattice model, you know, there's been a lot of work on edge modes and stuff where they kind of stop at this formula over representations and trying to start from there and get to this formula which works much more nicely for these larger groups. I was connecting to previous works, basically. But I think this is the place where you actually want to be starting.
Yes.
Is not the sum over representations, but just start off with, this was the Hilbert space, so just take the trace over that Hilbert space.
Is omega not the volume of the group or something like that?
Omega is basically like a volume of the group, but the important thing is that as I kind of take bigger and bigger subgroups, it's not locally compact, so this Haar integral doesn't exist, and this omega also diverges. So it's the group is still too big to take a trace over as I take omega to be bigger and bigger. But actually, as physicists, we're very comfortable with taking integrals over not locally compact spaces because this is just what a path integral does for you. And so what I'm going to do is instead of considering a trace, I'm just going to replace this with, I'm going to think of omega as defining what I mean by the measure of my path integral. And I'm doing a path integral over the embeddings now. And this path integral over embeddings, again, you can think about the embeddings as just being associated with elements of this corner symmetry group. And so now I'm doing a path integral over the embeddings of the region and not just the fields within it. Okay? And the reason why I wasn't too worried about these complications, about representations and stuff, is because, you know, when you want to define the path integral as rigorously as possible, you put the theory on a lattice and you take the limit as the lattice spacing goes to zero. And as long as you're comfortable with like what your measure is in the continuum limit, then it doesn't really matter the specifics of the lattice model. And so I'm imagining the same thing here, where now I'm doing a path integral over this not locally compact group, and this ends up taking the form of path integral over embeddings. All right. So what I'm going to do now is I'm going to use the replica trick. So I had I have this entropy which has a rho log rho in it, and I'm going to convert this into an integral over a trace of rho to the n and take an nth derivative. This is a very common trick in quantum information because calculating logs is very hard. The next thing we're going to do is after we've taken the replica trick, I have a trace over QFT degrees of freedom, and in QFT, I know a way to present this trace in terms of the Euclidean path integral. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to do the Euclidean path integral over a replicated version of this manifold because it's rho to the n, and so I need to consider n copies and glue it together in a particular way. And notice that the action, this A, right, the actual thing I'm replicating, I'm imagining is some abstract causal diamond which I'm gluing together. And what I'm doing is I'm taking this embedding and using the action of the fields pulled back to the original manifold using this particular embedding. So this is how the actual edge modes are affecting the action, is through a pullback. Okay, and then what I'm going to do is, because I'm taking the G Newton goes to zero limit at the end of the day, I'm going to take a saddle point approximation for the bulk path integral. And I'm left behind with some on-shell action, which I'll refer to as I sub n. And this n I sub 1 is basically just making sure that rho was normalized in the first place. So really, I should have included it in the second line, but it got a little busy. So the last thing I'll point out is that I wrote ECS mod diff. And what I'm trying to say there is that really what you should be doing is only integrating over gauge equivalent orbits of the embeddings. Because I've integrated out this diffeomorphism divisor term, and so I just need to keep track of that. And I'll talk more about that in just a few slides. So again, I've gotten to a point where I've taken a path integral and I've taken a saddle point over the bulk degrees of freedom, but I'm still left behind with another path integral. And because the on-shell action is also formally proportional to 1 over G Newton, I'm also going to take a saddle point of the edge mode path integral as well. And what I'm left behind with is an on-shell action which minimizes which is the minimum, because that's what solves the saddle point equation. And when I take the nth derivative and set n equals 1, I get the following expression. And for sake of time, I'm not going to go into the details there, but this is the same trick as people normally do in holography, where you evaluate the on-shell action, and you're left behind with a walled entropy. And what we get, though, is the walled entropy with a minimization over the embeddings of my region. And you can see now how this is essentially the Busso-Pennington conjecture. Now we just need to describe why only outward deformations, which is related to this restriction on minimizations. So now the last question we need to answer before we're done is characterizing this this space we're minimizing over. And what I'm going to argue for you is that this space is actually what's restricting you to outward deformations in the first place. It's not something you're putting in by hand. So the first question is, should we really just be minimizing over all possible embeddings? And the answer is no, and here's why. Is because the entropy, which I wrote as a sum over an average over representations, in general is not going to be zero, right? Because if it's an average over positive terms, then in general that's going to be a non-zero number. But if you let yourself vary over all possible embeddings, you can always take the embedding where the region shrinks to a point, so the area term is trivial, and as long as the global state is pure, then the von Neumann entropy term is zero as well. So because 0 is generally not equal to 0,
does that hold for a rising?
So, right, with the horizon, maybe we could talk about it at the end, because I think I'm almost out of time. So the thing I want to emphasize is that the path integral is automatically imposing restrictions on the allowed embeddings. And now we're going to explain why, how you can see why it's outward deformations in particular. And essentially, it comes down to the fact that from the viewpoint of the extended Hilbert space, I said diffeomorphisms on A were a gauge symmetry. But when I broke it up, right, from the original Cauchy slice, really I had already picked an embedding for the region when I was talking about that. So HA actually has a gauge symmetry of diffeomorphisms in the target space as well. So why is this important? Because if I pick some, my favorite embedding, call it phi sub g, I consider an embedding which is perturbatively close to it, which I'll call delta times phi sub g. The extended Hilbert space still has a gauge symmetry of the original embedding that is not, because this one is only infinitesimally far away. Now, what I'm saying is that whether or not a Hilbert space has a gauge symmetry or not, it doesn't matter what state you're considering. A gauge symmetry is a gauge symmetry. And so the gauge symmetry is unchanged if I consider a state which is slightly deformed inwards. So what I can do is I can do a diffeomorphism with compact support on the original region, which is the blue plus the green, which pushes it back out. And suddenly, I have the original region again. So what this is saying is an inward deformation was gauge equivalent to just doing nothing for this particular embedding. Whereas if I consider an outward deformation, there's no diffeomorphism with compact support on my original region, which is now just in blue, which sort of pulls it back in. So the thing that's breaking the symmetry between inward and outward deformations is the fact that you have a diff A gauge symmetry, which knows nothing about diff A prime. Okay. And I have a story about how you can think about this in terms of tensor networks, but I think I'm out of time, so I think I'll skip that for now. And so just to recap what I've done for you today is my goal was to compute the entropy of a subregion around a semi-classical background, some fixed state psi. And the proposal is to use a bulk path integral where you not only integrate over the bulk fields in the region, but you also integrate over the embeddings of this region into the spacetime. This was used, we thought about edge modes, which are just a feature of any gauge theory, but there's nothing inherently to the fact, you know, you could present this path integral in a different way, and then you don't have to worry about edge modes. We did a saddle point approximation, and we showed that the entropy of this region is sort of the minimum, is the minimum generalized entropy of all regions which contain it. And if you let the embedding, which actually attains this minimum, and you just define the entanglement wedge to be equal to that that particular embedding for your region, then this region E of A exactly satisfies the conditions laid forth by the Busso-Pennington conjecture. And at no point in this did I assume that A was embedded within an ADS spacetime because it was just a causal diamond, and so I only needed to worry about the dynamics in that region. The asymptotic behavior actually wasn't very important for this argument. So just to conclude, we proved the Busso-Pennington conjecture for what the entropy of a bulk subregion is. There's an obvious question. You know, I assumed that it was on a static slice because I was using Euclidean path integrals everywhere. Upgrading this to dynamical spacetimes would be a very interesting direction for future work. There's a lot of abstract things going on here. You know, it's not very concrete. So actually doing an explicit example in JT where the diffeomorphisms of the corner are just permutations because it's just a point. So there's hope that that's actually tractable to compute there. And there's a lot of interesting connections with von Neumann algebras and these observers with local regions, but I'll talk about that if someone asks a question about it. And the final thing is that, strictly speaking, we did not prove that the information in this entanglement wedge is encoded within the original region. All we proved was that the entropy has that form. But if you consider both the fact that if you take A to limit to be a boundary region, and for A in ADS, and in ADS, it is true that you can reconstruct these operators, and that this region E of A satisfies all the conditions that motivated entanglement wedge reconstruction in the first place, motivates the fact that probably that we conjecture that you should also be able to reconstruct the operators analogous to ADS CFT. So this corner symmetry group you can think of as a finite dimensional version of the BMS group, which is important for flat space and celestial holography, hence the name terrestrial holography, and better understanding how we can use these edge modes to understand local quantum gravity is where we plan to go next. So thank you for your time.
Any questions?
What prevents you from analyzing the covariant cases, not only the this kind of static cases?
Yeah, that's a good question. So what's the hurdle to dynamical spacetimes? Well, one is that you have to be a lot more careful when you talk about path, like Euclidean path integrals. And so technically, that's one thing. Now, I mentioned that the RT formula has been generalized to covariant cases. So obviously, that can't be the only hurdle. Another thing is that you actually, so the fact that you get a single region, a single entanglement wedge, is in some sense an artifact of the saddle point approximation, right? Because I took a single minimum, and that gave me a clean region of the entanglement wedge. And actually, even in ADS-CFT, when you include the next to leading order corrections in what's called like the replica symmetry, you actually get a splitting of this entanglement wedge into two regions, into like what's called the min wedge and the max wedge. Not just a single. It's like the entanglement wedge bifurcates into like a bigger and a smaller one. And what's interesting is that what Busso and Pennington found is that if for dynamical spacetimes for compact regions, even in the G Newton goes to zero limit, you still get this splitting into min and max wedges. Now, exactly why that happens and how to use this sort of approach to justify that behavior and upgrade it from a conjecture to an actual model is something that we're leaving to future work. But that's one of the key things, is that you expect a bifurcation into two regions instead of just one.
Maybe a naive question. So the inequality is satisfied by the entropy of a subregion in CFT on the boundary. These have been powerful enough to prove the anek and the qnek by relating the entropy to the modular Hamiltonian.
Yeah.
Is there some expectation that the Lusso-Pennington conjecture allows us to be pushed more? And
so I think with the all the proofs I said of proving like strong, of saying that, oh, this region does satisfy strong subadditivity, it does assume like the quantum focusing conjecture when you assume that that holds. Now, the reason I say that is because the quantum focusing conjecture is deeply related to like the to these energy conditions with quantum fields. And so it's not clear to me, I'm trying to be careful to make sure it's not circular, that you're not assuming the quantum focusing conjecture to prove like the qnek, but really you should not be assuming that to prove it in the first place. Does that answer your question?
Yeah.
Cool.
I'm struggling to speak right now.
Let's talk after. Let's talk after.
So if it's my last question to derail it. Like, as much as you say that the corner symmetry is like related to BMS, like the part of the corner symmetry is almost like the opposite, I mean, like the complement of what the BMS generators are, right? Because if I was at spatial infinity, I wouldn't want to move by zero. I would want to go to the transition to that zero. And then, like, similar with the horizon, I think I'm using some part of the S2 with these rotations in the S2. Now, when it comes to, I guess, Connor's question, like, I can relate the charges from super transition super rotations to like the anek operators in that context, but I don't know, like, maybe to what extent, when they throw away the BMS degrees of freedom, do you think like the entropy would just get another term and they'd still be there, or the point is that you get the area law without it, and so like anti illusion and then what are you doing? The opposite of the corner symmetry, that's the relevant one for the area law.
So one thing to say is that with this formula, right? This log D term in lattice gauge theories exhibits an area scaling because you have one copy for every point on the boundary. And so people have conjectured that this is the term responsible for the area term in the Bekenstein-Hawking entropy.
You get that with anything with SL2, not just the R2 rep, right? Like
exactly. So that's the thing I was going to say, is that I personally am not very convinced by that for a few reasons. One is that it exhibits area scaling in gauge theories, like Liang-Mills theory as well as gravity. And so it doesn't feel to me very gravitational. Another is that all of the graviton degrees of freedom are located in this row of R. And so if you want to associate, and then also in order to regulate the divergence as these representations get really big, we needed to cancel it off with this log P term anyways. And so it seems that somehow the area term is actually hidden within the row log row instead of this log d of r. Now, what you're saying, like, oh, you're considering a different part of this group when you're doing all that stuff.
Right. Okay, like you're saying, like the part that normally is BMS, you're saying is zero or not acting, and then you only look at the reps of the part that I think is.
Maybe we could talk after about comparing this group to BMS, but I know that there is a it's a little subtle to actually match that, but there is a way to actually think about it that way. But let's talk about that after. Okay, yeah.
Any questions?